to Tea, Tonic, and Toxin, a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a cup of tea, a gin and tonic, or...
But no, not a toxin.
No, not a toxin, actually. And join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every single one of them a game changer.
Carolyn, what are we talking about today?
We are reading and talking about The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. It's the first of two Wilkie Collins books that we're doing. Next month, we're going to talk about The Moonstone, but this month, Woman in White, and I have to say, I'm excited about this book.
That's cool. I'm excited, too. I'm also excited. I think we have a sponsor today.
We do have a sponsor today. Today's sponsor is Linden Botanicals, and you even have a Linden Botanicals mug that you're drinking out of.
Right. Mention of this. I don't, you know, you design these mugs, should it face towards you or should it face outwards?
It's so confusing. And yet, we're figuring it out live. Linden Botanicals provides some of the world's healthiest teas and extracts for all kinds of problems and challenges and health concerns that people might have, whether it's for brain health or joint health, memory, mood. The website is www.lindenbotanicals.com. lindenbotanicals.com. And thank you for being our sponsor.
Yeah, thank you. I actually really like their stuff. I gotta buy a big humongous bag of
Philanthus Neruri. It's the company's flagship product.
Yeah, we just make a big pot in our percolator.
Yeah. It's a very good, very healthy, all natural tea from Peru.
Sweet.
Yeah. So, Woman in White. What we're going to do is summarize the plot in case you haven't read it, but you just really enjoy listening to Sarah and me. Why wouldn't you? So, I'm going to go through a plot summary here, and it's a big book. Last couple books have been pretty big, Bleak House and then Woman in White.
Yeah, so we actually divided this into two podcasts, mm-hmm. and this is the first one.
This is the first.
They're not chronological, so if you're listening to the second, no big deal.
They're standalone episodes. This first episode is going to focus on general ideas from the book and also about the fact that it's a sensation novel and a detective story. And the second half, or the second podcast, will focus on two of our most interesting and favorite characters, two of my favorite characters for sure.
I'll agree with most interesting.
Most interesting. Marion Halcombe and Count Fosco. All right, so let me get through some plot here. The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins is one of the first sensation novels and one of the first detective stories. The characters use many sleuthing techniques that have since become common in mysteries and thrillers. The book also uses multiple narrators and narratives. In the preamble, Collins writes, "The story will be told by more than one pen as the story of an offense against the laws is told in court by more than one witness." The story begins like this. While walking home from Hampstead, just outside London, a young drawing master named Walter Hartwright meets a mysterious woman in distress. She's dressed entirely in white. He helps her find her way, but soon learns she has escaped from a mental asylum. The next day, he travels north, where he has secured a position at the home of Frederick Fairley, a wealthy hypochondriac. Mr. Fairley has hired Hartwright to tutor his lovely niece Laura and her devoted half-sister, Marion Halcombe. Hartwright quickly sees that Laura resembles the woman in white. Marion and Walter launch an informal investigation and discover that the name of the woman in white is Anne Catherick. Anne had lived in the area as a child and was devoted to Laura's mother, who first dressed her in white. Now, Anne sends a letter to Laura warning her about Laura's fiancé, Sir Percival Glyde. Anne also convinces Hartwright that Sir Percival was the guy who shut her in the asylum. Meanwhile, Hartwright and Laura fall in love. However, Laura promised her late father she would marry Sir Percival, and she follows through. Brokenhearted, Hartwright joins an expedition to Honduras. After their honeymoon, Laura and Sir Percival return to his family estate. the aptly named Blackwater Park. They're joined by Marion and Sir Percival's friend, Count Fosco, a cultured, heavyset Italian who's married to Laura's aunt. Marion learns that Sir Percival is in serious debt. Sir Percival tries to force Laura to sign a document that would allow him to use her large marriage settlement of £20,000. Marion is outraged and won't allow Laura to sign. At the same time, the woman in white, Anne Catherick, reappears, promising to reveal a secret that will ruin Sir Percival. Marion takes a big risk, eavesdropping on Sir Percival and Fosco in the rain. Soon after, Marion collapses with a fever. While Marion is ill, Laura is tricked into traveling to Count Fosco's house in London, where she dies. Except that Laura isn't really dead. No, instead, the woman in white is the one who died, and Sir Percival and Count Fosco switched Laura's and Anne's identities in order to steal Laura's money. Anne has been buried as Laura, while Laura has been drugged and placed in the asylum as Anne Catherick. While Marion finally recovers, she's shocked to find Laura alive and locked away in the asylum. Marion helps Laura escape from the asylum just as Hartwright returns from Honduras. Marion, Laura, and Hartwright hide out in London. Hartwright and Marion are determined to restore Laura's identity, and Hartwright finally discovers Sir Percival's secret. See, years later, Sir Percival forged the marriage register at a local church to conceal his illegitimate birth. He's not the rightful heir to his estate or his title. Sir Percival sets fire to the church to try to destroy the evidence, but he dies in the fire. Hartwright also learns that the woman in white was Laura's half-sister, which accounts for their resemblance. Hartwright enlists the help of his Italian friend, Professor Pesca. Count Fosco sees Pesca and recognizes him as a fellow member of an Italian secret society. Hartwright uses this knowledge to his advantage, forcing Count Fosco to write a detailed confession of the conspiracy. Afterward, Fosco flees, but the secret society catches up with him and kills him in Paris. Meanwhile, Laura's identity and fortune are restored soon thereafter. She and Hartwright get married, and they, their baby, little Walter, and Marion live happily together. Lots of plot summary, but boy, that's a big book to summarize.
It is. There's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. A lot of plots and subplots.
So, Sarah, let's just start with basics. Tell me how you felt about this book.
It was a tough read for me. I'll be honest. I read a lot. I'm sure not as many as you, but still a lot for the average person. Victorian novels. Mm-hmm. And rarely have I struggled like this. What I struggled with was the way so much of the novel is framed between this is what a woman is like and this is what a man is like. And always masculine and feminine and, you know, the way it was used to kind of support the plot going along. But just, you know, the way the characters used it really, I felt like it was really tough to read, and I kept setting it aside, and I was like, I'll come back to this. I'm struggling right now. Maybe this will stop. Maybe it's only this one character's beef, but it just kind of, it framed the whole novel. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that kind of tied with some of my own personal baggage around, like, what is masculine and what is feminine, that I had a really hard time with it. Although, you know, I can't, the story's interesting. Mm-hmm. But I'll say for me, this is what I felt like. I have a hard time with horror movies for several reasons. But one of the reasons is kind of the stress. You know, when you're watching a movie, you're watching a horror movie, and some character in the movie keeps doing dumb stuff. And you're like, no, what? Why are you doing that? And they keep doing it. That's what a lot of this felt like to me. Not that there's any horror in it, but I was just like, what? Mm-hmm. What? Are you crazy? So that's where I struggled there. But not, I think you had a really different perspective and take on it, right?
Well, I loved it. In particular, the middle. So it's broken into three parts. And the second epic, which is the second part, I just thought was amazing. Marion narrates it, and it just felt well-paced. I kept turning the pages. I stayed up a little later than what I thought I was going to stay up reading on various nights. It felt fresh and interesting and new to me. Now, I studied Victorian literature in graduate school and never read Wilkie Collins. I have no idea how I never read this book before.
That is funny. Is he not considered, like,
a prominent
Victorian writer?
He was. Yeah, he was considered. But, you know, I didn't get to it. I don't know why. I don't know how. But it was an oversight. I'm just gonna say flat out, complete oversight.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. You told me just a few minutes ago that he was best friends with Dickens.
Yeah, during the middle parts of their lives, my understanding is that they were very close friends. They were both publishing an all the year round publication. Dickens was sort of a mentor to Wilkie Collins. He was several years his senior. And Wilkie Collins was influenced greatly by Charles Dickens, in particular, A Tale of Two Cities, which he thought was a fairly perfect story. And there is, of course, a case of switched identities in A Tale of Two Cities, Carton and Darnay, two guys who look stunningly similar, who switch identities. And so we see that in The Woman in White. So we can see maybe, you know, some influence there. And yeah, I was blown away with it. There are parts of the book that I liked less than other parts, for sure. Hartwright's narration kind of left me a little bit cold at times.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, for me, I felt like there wasn't a solid character I could get behind and root for, mm-hmm. which I really like in mm-hmm. a book or a movie, for that matter. I just kind of want to feel strongly on someone's side instead of, like, you know, just this little, like, they're always getting on your nerves. Mm-hmm. that's a little bit what I felt. But as I was reading, I thought, well, I'm probably not appreciating this from a literary perspective. I know that I'm not. And I kind of wondered, like, your take on sensation novels and what are those and why is this one and what did that spawn?
Yeah, so if you have not read it yet and you're, you know, just going on the plot summary I read, I strongly encourage you to read this book. It's pretty amazing. There's a ghostly woman, switched identities, paranoia, forged documents. There's, you know, mysterious herbs and medicines and drugging, bribery, spying, foreign agents, blackmail, conspiracy. It's just like all this stuff going on. For me, it really was a forebear to a lot of mystery and thriller crime novels, you know, that I've read in recent years. I think they owe a lot to Wilkie Collins, and I think it's so interesting. Definitely a sensation novel. You know, my understanding of this is fairly limited, so any listener who knows more, please weigh in. We want to hear from you early and often at our website, which is tetonicandtoxin.com. We also have a Facebook and Instagram page. So come in, correct me, weigh in, you know, share some thoughts. But my thought is, from what I've read, Wilkie Collins was writing weekly serials versus Dickens, who often wrote monthly serials. So the way a weekly serial works is you've got to have, you know, I think it was something like 40 sections or chapters ending with like a oh my god moment, and so that fits right in with a sensation novel where it's like if everybody's behaving perfectly, if everybody's using their heads, you know, rationally, if everybody is, you know, a smart cookie, we don't get very far in this book. So we need people to be blind to various things, to not see what's in front of them, to struggle, to we need all of these things, because at the end of each section or chapter, we need the characters like confused and what do we? Oh my god, this other thing happens.
We need the subscribers to eagerly await the next issue.
Yes, exactly.
Which I can say there were, you know, there's lots of twists and turns, lots of things going on mm-hmm. for sure. So are sensation novels just kind of like a subset of Victorian novels? Mm-hmm. Did they span outside of this era or did they kind of stop along with it?
Oh, I think they live today. I mean, I think, yeah, cool. I think we have novels. Gosh, when I was a I don't know, junior high school, I think I was homesick and my mom had some novel. And it was like a sort of romance novel, but not purely romance. And the woman wakes up and everybody starts calling her some name, and that's not her name. And she's confused, and she's the narrator of this book. It's not a well-written book. And I honestly can't even remember who wrote the book, but they're all basically, this is like this household-wide subterfuge, pretending that, oh, well, your name is Jane. And she's like, my name is Cindy, or, you know, what have you. And the, her whole backstory, and everybody in the house is aligned with who she is and what she's all about. And she's like, no, that's not true. And because we're hearing from her voice, and because the writer is not, you know, maybe one of the best writers in the world, we get the sense the writer is not giving us an unreliable narrator. What we're getting is a woman thrown into chaos by an entire household that's trying to do something nefarious. I think this kind of book is common.
That makes me think, like, you know, maybe most novels today are sensation novels. You know, maybe it just kind of expanded to how we write novels.
I was actually thinking
that. I was thinking, Twilight sounds like a sensation novel. But maybe most romances, maybe a lot of fiction, every few chapters, even if it's pretty sophisticated fiction, you know, that's how you write it, kind of makes maybe a page turner.
Yeah,
is a sensation novel.
Yeah, where like every chapter seems to end with, oh my God, like what just happened? Yeah. You know? Yeah, I think he spawned an entire form, to be honest.
That's cool. That's very cool. Oh, did you mention it's also a detective story, or in what ways is it a detective story? I guess sensation novel and detective story aren't synonymous.
No. Mm-mm. So, you know, it had all of those, like, you know, ghostly woman and spying and all of, you know, forged documents, all that sort of, like, you know, big to do. But it's also a detective story. So they're at the end of the day, Hartwright, I don't know why that's difficult to say, and Marion are trying to solve a conspiracy. So what are your thoughts on the detective elements of this story?
Well, I couldn't quite, you know, from a literary standpoint, I couldn't say these are the elements of a detective novel. But certainly, you know, I was kind of struck at the end of the novel, after Hartwright kind of puts all the pieces together, he actually takes a minute to explain, you know, from his perspective, it's like, why being poor helped him solve the mystery. But I kind of saw it from the perspective of why the normal legal routes would not have solved the mystery.
Sure.
So that was pretty interesting. He's definitely an amateur detective.
So why wouldn't the normal legal routes have aided here?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a couple things involved, such as like the mysterious foreign society that needed to be infiltrated in order to have the leverage to force a confession out of Count Fosco, which, you know, just going to court would not have procured those sorts of things.
Sure.
But because he was poor and desperate and in love, he went beyond the typical legal route in order to obtain the necessary legal
motivated.
Evidence.
Highly
yes.
Motivated,
yeah. Yeah, there was a couple, I guess, conversations around being poor and being rich that honestly I thought were irrelevant. So I kind of thought, I don't know, you know, if he's on topic on that one or correct on that one. There was that where it's kind of like, well, I don't think it's because you were poor that aided you, unless you're just a lazy rich person who wouldn't have really sought it out.
So, like, along those lines, then, Hartwright starts in Epic One. There are three epics or three parts to this book. He starts Epic One, and he's doing some sort of cursory investigation, I would say pretty clumsy detective work. And then he comes back from Honduras in at the end of the second epic, and he narrates most of the third epic. And he seems like a changed man. So poverty maybe aided him, maybe it didn't, but some other things did seem to make him savvier in some ways at the end. Like, what did you think about the evolution of Hartwright?
So I guess I didn't necessarily feel he was, it was towards the end that I wrote the word dummy so much. Like, by his name, I was like, dummy, dummy. Every time he would do, it was such a bizarre. I thought Wilkie Collins must be trying to explain why his person isn't doing very obvious things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, after I got there, it occurred to me maybe I should wear a disguise. and then he has some kind of moral feeling about how he didn't want to wear a disguise. Okay. And there were several things that I'm like, what? So stupid. Why are you doing that?
Right.
One was like, it didn't occur to me, like, I would actually need the copy of the register certified. They don't just take my word for it that he lied. You know, like, mm-hmm. What?
When nobody took anybody's word for anything, which is so.
Oh, wait. I just remember another one. Before he walks into Mrs. Catherick's house, he's on this whole train ride to get over there, right? Mm. And he gets up to the door and he's like, I hadn't thought about what I'd say when I walked in. And I was like, what have you been thinking about on the train the whole way over here?
You couldn't write down a note?
Yeah, so I guess maybe it's probably me, but I missed the evolution of Hartwright. And I kind of thought, his dedication increased. And he himself seemed to tie that to the increase in Laura's ineptitude and, like, brainlessness. And that really bugged me.
She gets spacier and less functional as an adult woman.
The amount of times he compared her to an actual child and how condescending he was and how cute it is while I'm lying to her about her income. And she's saving it up for something nice. And I just couldn't take it. Yeah, I was so irritated.
So he and Hartwright and Laura, who he ends up marrying, and Marion, who is Laura's sister, the three of them are hiding out in London in this apartment together. And you know, for a long time, he's not married to Laura. This is a big deal, by the way.
Yes.
Like, in 1860, this is a big deal, what they're doing.
He's pretending to be their brother, I believe.
Something like this. And in essence, he's the father of the house. Marion's the mother of the house, and mm-hmm. Laura's the child. It's this really weirdly functional.
It's really, they wouldn't even let her, like, clean a dish. You know, she just did nothing.
She can't be, like, let in on any of the. You know, Hartwright and Marion are full force, you know, investigating what's going on, and Laura can't even be made aware of what they're doing.
Her brain's too fragile.
Poor Laura. And also, I mean, to that end, right, Laura never narrates anything in this book.
No, she doesn't.
Neither. I have to say, the woman in white, Anne Catherick, I wish she had narrated something.
Yeah. Although her brain was, like, legit fragile. You know, she seemed to have, like, some kind of learning disability and a lot of neglect in her childhood.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, I wanted to believe that she was fine and she was on target. But, you know, by the end, they really spell it out that she was not correct in her thoughts.
Right.
And so I guess I felt like, okay, well, she didn't hear anything. She has some disabilities to contend with.
But she doesn't at any point seem spacier or less connected to reality than Laura. Or at least Laura from middle of the book onward. So Laura is so traumatized that she actually, this was interesting. Like, Laura is in the beginning of the book described as a beautiful young woman. Oh, so pretty. Oh, it ages her.
Yeah.
She goes through so much trauma.
Yeah.
At the hands of her husband, Sir Percival, and Percival's friend, Count Fosco, that Hartwright returns from Honduras and sees her. And he's like, oh, my goodness. Like,
yeah, her own family stops recognizing her. She really, because they often said, oh, the woman in white looks like Laura if Laura had been through a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. And then after she goes, but is it a lot that Marion got sick? Is it that much? That's where it kind of killed me, is like the, you know, Anne's actually been imprisoned in an asylum, neglected in her childhood. She has has actual disabilities. Laura's described as really, like, clever and smart and sweet. And, like, what actually happened? Marion got really sick.
Right.
Laura was super worried.
Mm-hmm.
So she lost the ability to think about it.
And then, of course, so here's the missing, this, in my mind, this is the missing puzzle piece. And this, I feel, is a loss for the book. Wilkie Collins, I'm talking to you, you know, from the grave.
Listen up, Wilkie.
Laura is put in this mental or lunatic asylum as Anne Catherick. So Sir Percival Fosco have switched the identities. Woman in White has died. And she's buried as Laura. Laura, the real Laura, the living, breathing Laura, is put in the asylum. And the asylum's told, this is Anne Catherick, the woman in white. And I think that that helped this trauma. I mean, this helped it along.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We don't ever think about, like, what it would have been like to hear from either the woman in white or Laura and their experience in the asylum. We never get any asylum, like, info.
Oh, that's true. That would be interesting to hear about.
I would love to hear. Like, well, tell me about this
life
asylum.
In a private asylum.
Yeah.
Which is much better, apparently, than a pauper's asylum. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Catherick makes that point.
Mm-hmm. And the footnote in my book, the Oxford World's Classics edition, says, in fact, the private ones are potentially worse than the public ones.
Oh, why? How so?
Because the public ones had made a lot of advancements over the years, and the private ones were sort of in name only. So it was like you got to hold your place in society by saying, oh, I sent my child to this one where I pay. But it's like you would just dump them there, and there would be no regulation or no outside body checking to make sure that anything is happening the way it's supposed to. If you want to hide somebody away, my understanding limited, again, you know, readers, listeners, tell me, you know, what your thoughts. But like, if you want to hide them away, you'd hide them in a private one.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense, actually, with like Mrs. Catherick's character.
Mm-hmm.
She's over there congratulating herself that she did her duty as mm-hmm. a mother by saying, well, not a pauper asylum, put right. her in a private one where you pay.
Because she's all about, Mrs. Catherick is all about show.
Yeah, she's really about her place in society mm-hmm. and who's bowing to her. Mm-hmm. And she was a strange character.
I feel like so much was made about these asylums and the swapping of identities, which was a major fear point for some women in 19th century England.
Apparently, it's really easy to get shut away.
Yes, so easy.
If this book is anything to...
Yeah, and so, you know, it's playing on fears, which is part of, you know, it's scandalous, it's sensational, people want to read this story. I wanted to be at the asylum. I wanted to see why this was such a torturous, terrible place.
Right, yeah, that's a really good point, because Anne, like, escaped it, and, mm-hmm. like, degenerated Laura's thinking. Mm-hmm. Like, the identity thing was really interesting to me,
mm-hmm.
How easy it was to put, and I don't know if this is true or not, but how easy it was to put Laura in there.
Yeah.
But then, like, the other time it really stuck out to me is when Hartwright married her. And I was like, well, who did you marry? What name did you sign in the register? Did
yes.
you sign Laura Glyde, who was supposed to be dead?
Right.
Did you sign Anne Catherick, who was actually, who did you marry in your register?
Did you put down Laura Fairley? Did you put, like, who
yeah,
did
Yeah, like,
you...
the church registry was apparently, like, a bindable legal document, and Percival could have been hanged for forging it, so what on earth did he put in the register?
Right, so forgery was a big deal, which, you know, I hadn't really thought about until we started reading Edgar Allan Poe at the beginning of this, you know, podcast journey back in January and February. But forgery is a big deal. And I believe the last public hanging for a forgery was maybe around 1837. So that he probably wasn't going to get hung for the forgery. And yet it's still it's huge. It's a big, big deal. Yeah, and so I really felt like at the end of the book, maybe the last 50 to 100 pages, it was just kind of like a lot of stuff thrown at you, but it was harder to engage with it. Whereas, so the book is interesting. It has all these different voices in it, like different people tell different parts of the story. And Walter Hartwright in the beginning of the book says the person best... most appropriate to tell that story will tell the story. And so, you know, he tells parts of it. The second of the three parts, Marion does most of the narrating. Heartrate does most of the third part narrating. So it goes, you know, person to person, essentially. It's interesting the way the story sort of evolves in that sense. You get these different stories. You get, and the end of the book really felt like Heartwright was like, I'm going to dump 1,000 things at you, reader, and I'm just going to throw them on the page. Like, here they all are. It felt sort of inchoate to me at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I could see that. To be honest, I was also rushing through the end. I'd set it aside so much at the beginning. Mm-hmm. That I was pushing to get through to the end. So I may not have, other than gathering the facts, devoted enough attention to, like, the presentation.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see what you're saying there.
Yeah. I loved Marion's part in the second book. And we're going to talk more about that in our next podcast. But I really felt engaged in that, in her voice and in the story she was telling and the detective work she was doing. And so some of the voices I respond to maybe better than others. Mm-hmm. And Heartwright's, I had a little trouble with Heartwright's.
Tell me about your trouble with Heartwright's. Because I know my troubles, but.
You know, he is a little bit sort of like the swashbuckling, like he comes in to save the day. He's considered the protagonist of this book.
Mm-hmm.
Our summary of the plot was, you know, several minutes long. If you summarize this book or look online for a 2-sentence summary, it's almost always, you know, Walter Heartwright, a drawing master, meets a mysterious woman and then investigates. And like, that's the summary of the book, as if all this other stuff doesn't happen, as if all these other characters don't rise up. So the two characters that will stick with me are Marion and Count Fosco, not Walter Heartwright.
No, they're the two most interesting characters
mm-hmm.
in the book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's different kinds of masculinity in this book, right? So we have Heartwright, we have Count Fosco, Sir Percival, who marries Laura, and then Laura's uncle, Frederick Fairley. Like, what did you think about these? These are four very different men, but, you know, what do you think about them?
They were, I feel like, from the perspective of the writer, you know, similar to Dickens kind of setting Esther up as the perfect woman, I feel like, you know, Walter's being set up as the perfect man, but I can't agree. And then you have Frederick, who's like the hypochondriac, self-absorbed wimp.
Yeah.
He's like, he's everything that's terrible to the point that he's pretty comedic, and I liked his narrative.
It was so funny.
He was
the funniest one.
And it's Sir Percival. Okay, so this was the deal that I kind of felt about him. Like, all at the beginning, people would make these comments when he would act a certain way or do a certain thing that, well, it wasn't at all like a gentleman. And then, the part that killed me at the beginning, I had to set the book aside, was so this woman in white comes to Limeridge and writes this mysterious letter. And Walter's talked to her twice. And he's like, she doesn't seem insane. Somebody's put her in this asylum. She said it was Sir Percival. And they're like, well, we gotta ask Sir Percival what this is about. And they ask him, and he's like, no.
Wasn't me.
That's not right. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what happened. And then they're just all like, well, it's the word of a gentleman, so it must be true. I don't know why. Like, Marion, this is the first thing. I was like, Marion, I don't know. I just don't understand why. I can't get behind him. I'm just really doubting him, but I don't know why. Mm-hmm. Like, because there's a million reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
Marion, it's very clear why you might question this. So they set him up, you know, to always say he's not acting gentlemanly. And then at the end, you find out, oh, he's not a real gentleman because his father wasn't married to his mother, even though he wanted to be. But he couldn't. So, you know, it all pieces come together. And I just felt like this is kind of a false vindication of gentlemanliness.
Mm-hmm. So So let me ask you this, right? So Sir Percival, when we first meet him, he's like this super smooth talker.
Yeah.
And they ask him tons of questions, and he has the absolute perfect response for everything. And even Marion says, well, I guess. I mean, it must be true. You know, he's that weirdly persuasive. He comes back after he marries Laura. They come back from their honeymoon, and he's a completely different person. Like, yeah. Does this feel real to you? Like, in your own life, does this feel like, to me, it was seemed very weird.
No, not exactly. No, I would say no. And I feel like Wilkie Collins kind of wrote that off in kind of a trivial way. They do this walking stick comparison, right? Where he's always getting a new walking stick, and he'll spend the whole walk carving the stick and then never use it again. He's just a person that gets bored.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you have the Count, who never gets bored of being diabolical. You know, he's like, I am going to win everyone over, and everyone's going to be in my power for the rest of my life. He's never bored of doing that.
Yeah.
But Percival apparently gets bored of that. But I thought, I don't think that's a great explanation.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely, you know, I know people that they seem really amazing when you start a relationship, and then they will kind of flip a switch on you. That's a real thing. But typically I find I just haven't been noticing at the beginning. Like, I haven't been really tuned in to the character traits, but
yeah,
I'd say there's some stuff there that I think is real and some stuff that feels like a little bit non-realistic.
Well, you know, I'm in marketing, so I work with a lot of salespeople, and a lot of them are fairly, like, you know, I don't, what's the word? Like,
unless schmaltzy. You come up with the word.
Schmaltz, like, you know, just even when they're greeting you or just talking to you, it just, there's some, there's like,
it's
this
a little much, you know?
It doesn't feel real. It feels like they put on some sort of costume or something, but it's like a verbal costume, and it's... And so I'm like, am I talking to a real person? And so I'm, but I sense that a lot of the time. I don't have a perfect radar for it, but I have a gut feel for that. And I feel like everybody's gut failed them with Sir Percival, except for the dog. The dog knew.
The dog knew. And I felt like there was a lot of denial of the gut. Like, Marion's gut was on target. She's like, I just don't feel like this is great, but I don't have any reasons. I'm like, no, you have all the reasons. You have so many reasons. Your feeling makes total sense. Like, the lawyer. Mm. Oh, Mr. Gilmore. I did not like that guy.
Why?
Because he is terrible. So he comes in at the beginning. He's like, Laura, what would you like to do with your money? Oh, I want to leave it all to Marion when I die. Sure. Okay, great. Well, if you get married, and I'm kind of hoping you don't, but if you do, well, I'll make sure that's noted. Then when it comes time to write it up, and Sir Percival's like, no, she must leave all the money to me.
Mm.
Does he tell Laura that? No, he doesn't. He goes to who he knows is an idiot, Frederick Fairley. And he's like, so what? These are the terms. I wouldn't let my own daughter get married under these terms. Oh, okay, you want her to get married? I'll never mention it to her. I'll never give her the opportunity to decide I don't want to get married under this gold-digging diabolical contract. You know, he just, and then he's like out of the story. Like, oh, I'm sick now. I can't practice.
And so the theory behind his being out of the story is that he couldn't be in the story any longer because he would have been able to vouch for Laura's identity.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
And so they bring in Mr.
But couldn't they go visit him?
Yeah, come on. He's just in Paris or something, yeah,
but
right?
The whole deal where he acted like his hands were tied, but he never brought it up to Laura, even though she'd be of legal age in like 6 months. That to me seemed bogus.
My favorite part, though, just even in this conversation, is how you threw your voice when you were, was it Marion or Laura?
I don't know. I do that automatically. What was it? Who was I imitating?
I know, and then she said this.
it was probably Marion, because I was mad at her for like doubting her instincts and doubting both instincts and facts, because he's a gentleman, and Laura's father had arranged it, who's like set up to be a hero. You could put him on this list of masculinity too, like
Laura's father.
Yeah,
yeah,
like he's this basically good-looking playboy mm-hmm. who is pretty cavalier yeah. with his relationships with women.
Yeah.
Marries an ugly one, and which I thought was fantastic.
So, I don't know that she was ugly.
Okay,
plain. Mrs. Catherick says she's ugly.
She is, but they do say that Marion takes after her mother,
mm-hmm.
and Hartwright says Marion's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
He just says ugly.
Yeah.
He says the woman is ugly.
With an exclamation quoting. Point. Yeah, he says she was ugly.
Like the Hartwright's, the obsession with, like, she has a mustache. He even details. She has mm-hmm. a mustache.
Yeah. And a big, strong, masculine mouth.
Yeah, like yeah. a good jawline is really coveted these days. But and her frank, open face like a man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what?
Yeah.
That just threw me for a loop. I had to pause.
Yeah. And when Hartwright goes off on his investigation, the third epic, the third part of the book, she stays with Laura and she's, for all intents and purposes, and we'll get into this more in our next podcast, the man of the house. She's
yeah.
taking care of the household.
Yeah.
There is something else I wanted to talk about. We had already kind of started to talk about it a little bit, but the shifting in narration. So Collins, in the preface to the 1860 edition, he says, an experiment is attempted in this novel, which has not, so far as I know, been hitherto tried in fiction. And that is that the story is told throughout by the book's characters. So it's interesting he says this has not been tried because it had been in several books, including Wuthering Heights. Wuthering Heights was published in 1847, and it has multiple narrators, including Lockwood and Heathcliff and Nellie, Isabella. Various people narrate this book.
Well, Bleak House had different narrators. It switched back and forth between...
And Bleak House is going to follow... The woman
oh,
in white.
Oh, right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, we said Dickens and Wilkie Collins were friends. So Dickens was probably in some ways influenced by this book and the experimentation Wilkie Collins did. But Wilkie Collins, at his core, was a storyteller. So I think this was just sort of his, hey, look at me. Nobody's done this before. And some
really?
Says, it. Yeah.
So you think he read Wuthering Heights?
Oh, I think he knew. I don't... Okay, if you read this book, you can see he is a well-read man, and he's a good writer. I don't for a second believe he wasn't aware of other books.
That's so bizarre mm-hmm. that he would... That's kind of a Count Fosco-y thing to do.
Yeah, it's very... No, I'm going to start saying that kind of thing. Oh, that's very Count Fosco of you.
Everyone will know. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Mm-hmm. And then... You can give them the podcast to listen to.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, Fosco and Marion, again, if you've not read this book, read it just to see the interplay throughout most of the pages between Fosco and Marion. It is amazing. I think it's amazing.
I think it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
I of all the characters, I probably like Count Fosco and then Frederick Fairley's entertaining, although, like... When he does the writing, he's entertaining. When
yeah.
you have to read about him, he's annoying.
So Wilkie Collins is really funny when he wants to be. Like, there are all these places in the margins that I just did, like, a smile face or something, where I was like, that is so funny. Just, he could be, like, very biting and very witty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, with it had its moments where I was sort of dragging near the end, but... I loved it.
How do you feel about him making, like, this false claim about his book knowingly? After setting Hartwright up to be, like, the perfect man of integrity, he's definitely not.
I'm less interested in Wilkie Collins as a person than I am on what is living on the pages. So I'm more interested in what he accomplished than who he was as an artist. And I tend to be that way with, you know, even contemporary artists, people who write and sing songs, actors. I'm more interested in what I'm seeing and hearing than the person behind the music or the art or the book. So I think it's interesting because he's a storyteller at heart and he told stories. He was known for telling stories about how he came up with this book, and a lot of them have been since debunked.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. You know what I know a lot of people who are, they're themselves storytellers, and you can kind of see when they get into a story, liberties are taken, especially if you were there and you know, and you're like, well, I don't. Okay, well, it does make it more dramatic, but.
Yeah. And you're like, I was there.
Yeah.
That so did not happen that way.
Once it was actually my story that someone kind of told as their own.
As their own story?
Yeah.
Oh.
I thought that was funny.
Did you call them out on it?
No, actually, I wasn't there for the telling. They told me later. They're like, oh, I took the story you told me and I made it into a monologue.
What?
Class. Yeah.
What?
I do weird stuff. They do theater. It works.
Oh. Okay. Okay, well, so that was it. Then it was sort of a creative endeavor. It wasn't like they were at a barbecue and they're like, listen to what happened to me last night.
No, it wasn't that. Okay. It was like they kind of turned it, into a theatrical story.
Yeah, but. So they beg, borrow, and steal your best material. And so, I don't know, I can kind of get behind that.
I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, but then it wasn't my story that was appropriated, so it's easy for me to say.
I didn't read the preface, so I actually didn't know that aspect about Wilkie Collins. That he wrote stories about himself as well.
Yeah, and so, you know, as a writer, I am familiar with everybody's origin story for how they wrote their book. And, you know, like Hemingway, you know, depending on who you hear and what writing of Hemingway's or what somebody overheard from Hemingway, there are all these stories about like, whoa, he wrote The Sun Also Rises in 6 weeks while drinking and hanging out with friends, or he, like, in other words, like, this thing was like evolved magically out of thin air and landed on pages perfectly typed. And, you know, like, the origin stories are a big deal for a lot of storytellers because it's different when you're like, oh my gosh, The Sun Also Rises is one of the best books ever written, and he did it in 6 weeks. That's incredible, you know. And so Wilkie Collins is in a long line of writers who have their story about their story.
Yeah. Well, as a writer, do you ever do that? Do you kind of embellish your origin stories?
You know, I think everybody embellishes some of the time, and I would say I surely do. However, I feel like I have so few origin stories in my writing that most of it's like, I've sent my manuscript to 400 agents and they've all said no. It's, in other words, so it's not like, you know, I was bored one weekend and so I knocked out a novel and I just found this, you know, name of an agent online and said, what the heck? And I emailed it to them and the next weekend they replied and they were like, this is awesome. Like, I don't have that story. I don't have that story. So
you'll get it though.
Thank you. Yeah. My story is more, I send it out a lot. Yeah. Yeah. And then I wait and I hear back sometimes. Sometimes it goes into this weird, like, novel vacuum of, you know, mystery and terror. So yeah,
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to say we have a giveaway winner this week.
We do.
We do. We did a little social media giveaway for a sticker, the coveted Tea Tonic and Toxin sticker of beauty.
It's a very nice sticker.
It a lot.
Yeah.
I really do like it.
Yeah.
I put it on our camping cooler where we keep all of our stickers of trips.
Yeah, and we have some. They're beautiful, purple and red and white, and you know, we have the tea and the tonic, the gin and tonic, I suppose, and the toxin you should not be drinking.
Yeah, don't pour a toxin.
No,
but yeah, so our winner this week was Linden Botanicals, actually our sponsor.
Yeah.
So good job, Linden Botanicals.
Yes, good job, Linden Botanicals. Michael Vanderlinden in particular.
Yes.
Yeah, the owner of Linden Botanicals.
You'll be getting a sticker.
It's very exciting.
All right. Well?
Well, Sarah, this has been a good conversation about this book.
Not
a small one, but I think super worthwhile.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're a book and you elicit a lot of feelings, even conflicting feelings in folks, you've done an interesting job of your job.
Mm-hmm. This book has never gone out of print, And really? there's a reason why. I mean, it's a very interesting page turner, I found.
That's cool. More next month on the most page turnery parts mm-hmm. of this page turner.
Yeah, we're gonna talk a little bit more about Marion and Fosco in our next podcast. And also next month we'll be reading The Moonstone, also by Wilkie Collins. It's a classic. Get started on The Woman in White and then jump right into The Moonstone.
Yes. Do it. All right. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Sarah.